Hello and welcome to Behind the News. My name is Doug Henwood. Even on a day when people are blowing things up to celebrate the glory that is the USA, Behind the News sticks to the two-guest standard. Robert Pape will explain how, despite months of death and destruction, Israel has barely made a dent in Hamas's strength, and Wanda Bertram of the Prison Policy Initiative will review the state of crime and punishment. Israel has dropped something like 70,000 tons of bombs on Gaza, a massive amount in a small, densely populated state, and killed almost 40,000 Palestinians by the official count, and almost certainly more. The stated goal of all this bloodletting is destroying Hamas, but there's little evidence that they've even begun to accomplish that task. While some military and political figures in Israel have conceded that that goal is impossible to achieve, on Monday, Prime Minister Benjamin Netanyahu claimed, "We are progressing to the end of the phase of eliminating Hamas's military," one of his many and frequent lies. Here with more is Robert Pape, professor of political science at the University of Chicago and director of its Project on Security and Threats. From 1991 to 1994, he taught at the U.S. Air Force's School of Advanced Air Power Studies. Pape is the author of a recent article in Foreign Affairs, the High Establishment Journal of the High Establishment Council on Foreign Relations, with the blunt but accurate title, "Hamas is Winning." Every time I have somebody like this on the show, I get strenuous complaints that they didn't sing from the left-wing songbook. Yes, I know this, but I think it could be very useful to hear from well-informed and thoughtful mainstream figures. Robert Pape. What was Hamas's status with the Gazan population on October 6th? How high were they regarded?
About a third of the Gazans supported Hamas on October 6th, and that's been a pretty steady state going back quite some time. And then overall, if you include Gaza and the West Bank, because those are the two pools of Palestinians who might support Hamas, about 25% of Palestinians overall supported Hamas on October 6th, and that too had been a steady state going back quite some time.
And what about the rest, the other two-thirds or three-quarters?
Before October 6th, Hamas was kind of in a neck-and-neck battle for support with Fatah. That's also the Palestinian Authority. That's the other main entity. And that's an entity that's in Ramallah, that's in the West Bank. And those were the two major bodies that got support, which only added up to about 50%. Keep in mind what I said. Hamas had 25%, Fatah 25%. So that means that half of the Palestinians were not supporting either Hamas or Fatah. There's a lot of splinter groups. There's a lot of supporting nobody in that period of time. So it's really not true that everybody in Palestine or, you know, all the Palestinians supported Hamas before October 6th. It's just a myth. It really had basically a support from a dedicated minority, I would say.
Okay, so now after a massive and deadly assault of over 8 months, is Israel succeeding at all in degrading Hamas as it's been planning to or hoping to?
Israel is clearly killing Palestinians and is killing some Hamas fighters. We don't have exact numbers, but there's no doubt that even Hamas admits that at least 6,000 of its fighters, and it claims it had about 30,000 before October 6th, which are numbers that dovetail with the Israeli intelligence. So we can assume that number of 30,000 Hamas fighters before October 6th was correct. Hamas itself claims that 6,000 of those fighters have been killed. Israel claims about double that number, and then the American intelligence estimates come halfway in between, about 10,000. So somewhere between a quarter to a third of Hamas fighters have been killed over the last 9 months. But this is not really, Doug, the right way to measure whether Israel is heading toward achieving its goal. It's a measure that plays very well in the press and with even intelligent parts of the public who just don't know much about waging counter-terrorist or counter-insurgency campaigns. Even the IDF spokesman just a few days ago came out and contradicted Benjamin Netanyahu by saying that it can't defeat Hamas. What is important to know is that there's a fallacy. I call it the body count fallacy in the foreign affairs piece that I published last week, which is very, very common. The idea that there's a fixed pool of fighters for a terrorist or insurgent group. And once you simply kill that fixed number, then the group disappears. And that's just simply a fallacy because these groups are in the business of campaigns, protracted campaigns of lethal violence, where losing fighters is a normal state of their operations. They are always in the process of losing fighters. And so the real power of a terrorist group is not in how many of the current generation you have killed, X percent. The real power of a terrorist group is, does the terrorist group have the ability to replenish, to generate more, recruit more fighters into the future?
I want to return to this in a moment, but let's talk a bit about Vietnam. The U.S. poured in massive ground forces, dropped millions of tons of bombs, and lost. What happened to the Viet Cong as we were sending in all those troops and dropping all those bombs?
They grew in size. So as I was saying, so many, many moons ago, when I started my graduate training, one of the things that led me to go down the road of studying political violence is I wanted to understand more about how we as this strong, great superpower of the United States with all these amazing advantages lost the Vietnam War. And I, too, started with a body count fallacy. And one of the things that I discovered is it's not just that we dropped all these bombs, but we killed over 900,000 Vietnamese in South Vietnam during the Vietnam War. That's an amazing number that we killed. Now, we did this also with the ARVN, that's the South Vietnamese Defense Forces. So it's not literally the Americans themselves, but nonetheless, that's a fantastic number of people that were killed. Well, what happened is during the course of all that major attrition, if we can use a nicer word for the killing, of the enemy grew in size. So the enemy starts out at being somewhere just under about 200,000, maybe at most in 1965 when the real ramping up begins. And then by 1968, 3 years later, it's like 275, even with all of those bombs falling, all of that, quote, attrition, to use a euphemism for that destruction of human life. And so what happened is the body count fallacy during the Vietnam War led many people to misestimate what was happening to the Viet Cong. Essentially, what happened is the more there was that direct attrition of the current fighting force of the VC, which in fact happened, the more there were bonds built with the local Vietnamese society that allowed the VC to grow its ranks over time. So you couldn't quite see it in any one month or even in just a few months, but over time, the VC started out, they controlled, you know, something like 3% of the territory in South Vietnam in 1965. By 1968, they were up to 22%. So this whole idea of, well, the way to beat a insurgent group is just to kill the current number just became a fallacy, and it became one of the key mistakes that whenever you go to take courses in military history or military strategy, the body count fallacy is just one of the famous strategic errors pretty much of the last 100 years.
I'm old enough to remember the Vietnam War, and the Hawks used to say at the time that the U.S. was fighting with one arm tied behind its back. Now, that always seemed a little fantastical, but can you even begin to say that about Israeli war making?
not even close with, yeah, so let's put aside the Vietnam War because it's not quite true there either. But with the case of Israel, it's actually the opposite. It's, they're fighting with both hands and then their other hands helping with more supplies and more weapons and more arms, mostly American hands. In the case of Israel, there's been increasing complaints by the Biden administration, and there's also been increasing separation diplomatically from Israel and the rest of the international community that's really quite severe. But that has not led to any real hamstringing of Israel's military operations. They are fully using, let's say, 2,000-pound bombs on a regular basis, which you might say, well, aren't those supposed to be very precise? And you hear that word precise. Well, when you drop a 2,000-pound bomb in a tightly, densely packed urban area, as we have seen in northern Gaza, central Gaza, southern Gaza, the bomb itself creates a 50-foot crater, which then has reverberation shock effects another 200-plus meters after that. So that 2,000-pound bomb, you could say, well, I'm trying to be very precise and just kill that one particular operative with that bomb. But when that bomb blows up, it's often bringing down apartment buildings, neighboring areas, sometimes even hospital areas. And this is then just creating massive collateral damage. And this has not really changed through the war. There's been ebbs and flows of quantity, but the actual tactics have remained fairly constant. It's just been about the quantity of use of those tactics that's ebbed and flowed over time.
You mentioned estimates of 10,000 dead and for the Hamas fighters, give or take a few thousand. What about the leadership? Is that mostly the rank and file that's getting killed, or the leadership taking any hits too?
Yeah, it's mostly the rank and file being killed. The top leadership here, there's been no losses, no meaningful losses. Sometimes Israel will claim it's killed a leader. Typically, these are these mid-level leaders. Those are like operational commanders. So think about that in an American military context as the loss of captains, majors, lieutenant colonels, but not the loss of generals or the very, very senior leadership. And it is the case that the skill set of that captain, major, lieutenant colonel has significant lethal experience and actual operational on-the-ground experience. However, there are, given the nature of the fighting here, which is now mostly from Hezbollah side, ambushes, booby traps, that kind of guerrilla warfare style fighting in an urban area, it is simply the case that there are going to be hundreds of replacements readily available who have nearly the same level of skill. Some of them will end up being even more skillful than the mid-levels who have been knocked out. The leadership level here of Hamas has really not taken a blow in any serious way. And you also, by the way, see that with ongoing negotiations we read about in the news, discussion of hostages and so forth. Hamas has its leadership in place, and it has a fair bit of governance. Now, not governance in the same ways that it had before October 6th, but just the very complaints by Israel that Hamas is able to steal, as Israel says, the humanitarian supplies. Well, that means Hamas is in control. So also the fact that it's Hamas that's the negotiating partner when it comes to hostages. Well, that means it's Hamas that's in control. It's not a situation where Hamas is somehow losing the core functioning governing abilities that really matter to it as a militant group.
How skilled is the IDF as a fighting force, just in purely military terms?
Oh, the IDF is one of the most skilled fighting forces in the world. So when I, before I went to the University of Chicago, I spent 3 years teaching for the U.S. Air Force at Maxwell Air Force Base in Montgomery, Alabama. I was teaching conventional targeting strategy to our operational fighters, pilots, and intelligence officers here, mostly at the major and lieutenant colonel level. So these are fairly skilled. And we would have a number of interactions with Israelis. The fact of the matter is we also went on training that even though I'm a civilian, I was allowed to go to get close to the action of the training to see how it played out. And there's really no doubt that on a sort of tactical level, putting bombs on a target or doing reconnaissance of a location, the Israelis are absolutely excellent. And in fact, there are many times in some very specific circumstances when our own folks that I was engaged in training with would have high respect here. So I think that it's just no doubt that the tactical proficiency of the Israeli military is absolutely terrific. But that doesn't lead into than necessarily strategic success. So another common fallacy that people might think, well, wait a minute, you just told me that these folks are just absolutely superb. Well, they're absolutely superb at putting a bomb on a target, but that doesn't mean that the consequences of what happens when the target blows up is the same level of effect. So a strategic effect where you actually whittle down the group over time where the threat would go away, that's the strategic effect. Also in the case of the Vietnam War, the American military, for all the complaining we do about the American military, was an absolutely superb fighting force in the Vietnam War, much better than the other fighting forces. Maybe the British were very close, but that did not mean that we enjoyed strategic success. In fact, famously in Vietnam, the American military would routinely say, we never lost a battle, but lost the war. Well, that's what's happening to Israel right now. They're not losing a battle. They're losing the war.
I'm speaking with Robert Pape, professor of political science at the University of Chicago, and author of a piece in Foreign Affairs on how Hamas has barely been dented. What is Hamas fighting with? It must be hard to get weapons and other support, given the intensity of the bombardment and the tight control of the borders.
In the Vietnam War, a lot of people said, oh, well, it must be the support from the north, where all these weapons are coming down through the Ho Chi Minh Trail and so forth. And the parallel here would be weapons from Iran. Well, it turned out that that was only like 3 or 4% of what the VC were actually fighting with. It turns out that the actual number of bullets, bombs, and so forth you need, very actual small amount, because again, you're basically setting up ambushes, you're ambushing patrols, you're using concealment. In the case of Viet Cong, it was from jungle. Here, it's basically the urban area. You're not coming in with huge artillery tubes and barrages. You're basically fighting with very, very small, what's called light weapons. And a lot of that is simply stolen from the Israeli forces. And a lot of that is also made from dual-use things in Gaza that are virtually impossible, unless you're literally going to kill all 2 million people in Gaza. It's impossible to stop that degree of dual use. So the fact is, much like the VC and much like other Hezbollah and other groups, a lot of the material that really matters in these close engagements with the, it was the American force in the case of Vietnam, the Israeli forces here in Gaza, a lot of this is much lower quantity than many people realize. And number two, a lot of it is coming actually from what they can steal from weapons on the battlefield. And then also, number three, from what they can make out of dual use. And also, we should also note that about 80% of the tunnels still appear to be intact and usable in Gaza. That means there's probably lots of stuff stored in there that we really don't know what those stockpiles look like. So it could go on for a long period of time before they run out of this lethal equipment. And cutting them off from Iran, that's probably the one thing that's not happening since October 7th, is that there's probably literally zero coming in from Iran at this point.
Israel loves to make the human shields argument that Hamas is using civilians as human shields. But what if the fighters are just deeply embedded in the population as a political fact, not just as a dark military strategy, but it's just, you know, what's that old line from Mao about fishes swimming among the people?
That's exactly right. That was Mao's line, Doug. So Mao famously, this was around World War I era, when he was fighting his guerrilla war and actually developing guerrilla tactics here around World War I, the 1920s. Mao Zedong became the leader of China by winning this guerrilla war, developed this idea that the fighters here were like fishes in the sea, where the sea was the population. And the sea was providing food. It would be providing some material that you could use for weapons and so forth. And Hamas and many guerrilla fighters since, guerrilla organizations since, have made a dedicated goal to embed themselves deeply in the local population. Because number one, the more local support they have, and this is really the taproot of the power of a terrorist group, its local support, the more local support they have, the more they can replenish its fighters. The more that they can find who has been disgruntled, who wants to join the group, and the more the other side kills of the local population, even collateral damage. The brothers often, the nephews of those who have been killed want to join and get revenge and don't want to join with the militant group. And so that whole idea of being embedded here, talking about it as human shields is both true but also superficial at the same time. It's really missing that there's a whole bonding that's been happening between Hamas and the local population, and it was only partial before October 7, as I was explaining. And what's happened since October 7 is that bonding has grown, you see, because the political support from the local population for Hamas has gone up, and that overall is the taproot of its growing power, the ability of the group to replenish losses into the future, to become more the political focal point of support for the Palestinian population. Before October 7th, Hamas and Fatah were, again, as I said, neck and neck. Each had about 25% support. Now, Hamas has about 40% support of the Palestinian population, and Fatah has fallen down to 20%. Hamas is now double the support of Fatah. What's occurring is the bonding with the local population is growing between the Palestinian population and Hamas, and this is the opposite of how you would defeat a terrorist group. To defeat a terrorist group, you need to separate the local population and you need to reduce the support of the local population for the terrorist group. And this is the big source of the strategic failure of the Israeli campaign in the last 9 months. They've done the opposite of what's necessary in order to defeat the power of Hamas. And in fact, Hamas is now winning and stronger today than before October 7th.
Not to be crude about it, but I would think that a 2,000-pound bomb dropped in a refugee camp is a pretty effective recruiting tool for Hamas.
It's pretty powerful. So we have some really quite excellent surveys of Palestinian attitudes, even with the ongoing war. And it's done by a Palestinian survey group in Ramallah that started with the Oslo Accords back in the 1990s. And this is a group that also works closely with Israeli scholars and Israeli institutions. And they've been doing quarterly surveys of Palestinian support in Gaza and the West Bank now for decades. And we can really track Palestinian support for Hamas and other groups, and also whether or not Palestinians want to support attacks against Israeli civilians. And we can really see whether or not those numbers are changing. Now, it is imperfect. I mean, this is a war time for Gaza. The survey group has bolstered its interviews. And so this really is the best window we're going to have into Palestinian attitudes since October 7th. And what you see is, number one, as I was explaining, Hamas's political support compared to its rivals is now double. I mean, it's really quite a significant power shift in favor of Hamas among the Palestinians. But also what you see is support among the Palestinians for attacks against Israeli civilians is up 50% since October 7th. And that is really quite stunning. And the most recent data for this is June 1st of this year, so literally just a few weeks ago. And so you can really see that one might hope or think that as there has been more attacks and punishment of Palestinian society, the Palestinians would pull back from Hamas, or they'd at least want to pull back from attacking Israeli civilians. The opposite is the case. And then a third element here is the survey group asks about whether Palestinian knows a family member or friend who's been harmed, killed by the war, and fully 75% of Palestinians in Gaza report that they've either had a family member killed or a friend killed since October 7th. You can see a picture here where it's essentially a picture of revenge, Doug. It's essentially a picture of the more punishment that's happening to the Palestinian society, This is putting them in a fight or flight mode, and they're choosing fight over flight. And this is not good for the safety and security of Israeli civilians. It's, of course, horrendous for the safety and security of the Palestinians. But if we look at it from the Israeli side, the whole point of this operation was supposed to reduce the terrorist threat to Israeli civilians. And that's just not the case. I mean, the only thing stopping the threat to Israeli civilians is literally the physical presence of the IDF. And that was the big failure on October 7th. So the change here is that on October 7th, the IDF showed up and actually defended the borders here with Gaza. And if you took that away here, all of this punishment on Palestinian society would not weaken the threat of Hamas. In fact, there's a good chance that October 7th would happen again almost immediately if the IDF were somehow to disappear again for 48 hours like they did on October 7th.
When Israel withdraws or reduces the intensity of its operations from a region, what happens? Does Hamas move back in?
Yeah, pretty much. That's what we've seen. So again, it takes a few weeks for this to happen. And the reason, Doug, that they're moved right back in, as you said, is because as Israel tells the local population, say, first it was back in the fall, it told about 1 million people in north and central Gaza to flee to the south. You know, hundreds of thousands moved, but so too did tens of thousands of Hamas fighters. Now Israel has reversed that and said, no, we want you to move back up or move somewhere else. And as hundreds of thousands of Palestinians again have moved, so too have the Hamas fighters. So you're basically seeing what was called in Afghanistan a game of whack-a-mole. That is, you knock out a group of insurgent fighters in Village A, and then they just pop up somewhere else. And so that idea of whack-a-mole is a name we created in Afghanistan for this phenomenon we've been seeing for over 100 years with guerrilla groups, which is the more they have power, that means the more they're embedded in the local population and the more they have support from the local population, and then the more they just move with the local population. That's just a big reason why we have all this movement, all this change of military operations inside of Gaza, but we're really not seeing the defeat of the group.
There's a long history now showing that aerial bombardment doesn't really destroy a population's will to fight. If anything, it intensifies it.
That's right, Doug. So in my first book, Bombing to Win, this was a book that I published in the mid-90s, and I studied every air campaign in the 20th century up until the point when I published the book. And that was 40 strategic air campaigns in all. And it's one of the few books to really study all 40. So there's many books will study one or two air campaigns. But the reason I wrote the book is because I discovered when I was looking around trying to understand why we lost the Vietnam War is there wasn't such a book that really just stacked up the top 40 air campaigns and really tried to figure out. And one of the big discoveries I made is that bombing civilians is really quite common in war. It's often done through euphemisms here and so forth. We called, for instance, Hiroshima a military target, even though there was no real military value to Hiroshima. But once you actually study the campaigns in detail, you can then see also the extent to which the degree of civilian punishment is breaking the back of the civilian population, reducing its morale, reducing its willingness to support the enemy government or not. And it turns out that the more you punish civilian populations, the more terrified they become of the punisher. So even though punishers say, oh, well, it's really, let's blame your leadership, Israel's saying, well, let's blame Hamas. We wouldn't be killing all these Palestinians if Hamas would just surrender. Well, from the Palestinians' perspective, they're choosing Hamas over Israel over and over again. And it's the same pattern we've seen for 100 years in 40 air campaigns, which is the more the attacker punishes the civilian population, the more the civilian population population is terrified by occupation by that attacker. They're afraid that the attacker is just going to be even more aggressive down the road. And so you end up stiffening the morale and you end up really strengthening your enemy, not weakening your enemy.
Okay, finally, just watching all this, it seems as if Israel's real goal may be to destroy Gaza as a functioning society and killing and displacing as many people as possible, maybe leaving the land clear for settlers. Is that what they're really trying to do and not just destroy Hamas, or just destroying Hamas require that kind of destruction?
So Doug, a lot of people are speculating what would be, you know, a goal that would make any sense given all the realities. And there are some policy papers by ministers who are part of the Israeli cabinet that would reflect exactly what you just suggested: ethnic cleansing in order to repopulate Gaza with Israeli Jews and so forth. But the fact of the matter is, we don't really know at this point. We can't really say that those policy papers are actually guiding the decisions. What I would say is, even if that were the goal, Israel is no closer to that goal than they were on October 6th. The fundamental problem that Israel has is that for that goal to really make any sense whatsoever, the 2 million Palestinians in Gaza would have to be reduced either by a third or a half. So at the moment, about 37,000 Palestinians have been killed. About another, say, three times that number have been wounded. So let's just round it to a little over 100,000. Well, that's nowhere near that 600,000, 700,000, a million that would actually have to be reduced in order to have that kind of an ambitious cleansing objective, as, say, we saw the Serbs have in Bosnia in the 1990s. And in fact, I would say that it's going to be much harder to have anything like this idea as you go forward, because you're already seeing that Israel's problems are multiplying on other fronts. The West Bank, lots of turmoil is happening among Palestinians and the settlers on the West Bank. So it's not just the Gaza problem. And then in the north with Hezbollah, you can see some of the leaders in Israel are very eager, apparently, to open up another front against Lebanon, against Hezbollah in Lebanon. And this just means that the security problems for Israel are growing. And so the idea that you would cleanse out of this area, build this whole new, you know, sort of extension of greater Israel that some of the religious right are calling for in Israel, it's always been a bit of a pipe dream. And now it's more of a pipe dream than ever, because the security situation is just becoming worse and worse and worse for this very tiny country with ultimately only 7 million Jews in the country.
That was Robert Pape, professor of political science at the University of Chicago and author of a recent article in Foreign Affairs, Hamas is Winning. Speaking of rampant violence, as I was putting this show together, the Israeli historian Benny Morris published an article in Haaretz urging Israel to destroy Iran's nuclear weapons facilities, using Israel's own nukes if necessary. A country that finds itself making perpetual war with its neighbors and deeming it a necessity clearly has some serious problems. My name is Doug Henwood, and the program is Behind the News. Back after a musical break. That was the 22nd of 36 variations of The People United Could Never Be Defeated, composed in 1975 by Frederick Jevsky, performed by Igor Levit. From time to time, I like to check in with Wander Bertram of the Prison Policy Initiative, prisonpolicy.org on the web, a group that puts out a lot of very useful information on crime and punishment in the U.S. One of their recent reports puts U.S. incarceration rates into perspective, specifically by comparing the 50 states with countries around the world. of the 10 most punitive jurisdictions in the world, measured by the share of the population behind bars, 9 are U.S. states, coming in just behind the world champion, El Salvador. Here with more is Wanda Bertram. It's not unknown that the U.S. incarcerates a larger share of its population than just about any other country on Earth, only El Salvador, Cuba, and Rwanda beat us. But how do the individual states stack up? If they were independent countries, how would they stack up?
Yeah, well, we just released this new report where we situate every U.S. state next to independent countries of the world. The idea of showing that, you know, not only does the U.S. have this nearly unparalleled incarceration rate, but every single U.S. state does as well. To start at kind of the bottom of the pack, Massachusetts, which is the state with the lowest rate of incarceration, would rank 30th in the world. So it would have the 30th highest incarceration rate in the world if it were an independent country. It has a slightly higher incarceration rate than Iran.
I thought that was striking, given the way we demonize Iran as an oppressive place.
Right. And I think a lot of people are shocked to see this stuff. That's why we put the report out for shock value. Year after year, we've done this report a number of different times, and the findings are always more or less the same. You know, you compare a state like Massachusetts or a state like New York to countries like the UK, France, Belgium, countries that have their own share of incarceration problems, to be clear. But most U.S. states incarcerate well over twice as many people per capita as these countries that we consider to be our peers in terms of being, you know, Western developed democracies.
Yeah, and New York, as you say, one of the less carceral, not the lowest, but, you know, in the bottom third or so. That beats Russia. New York State beats Russia, which is another one of these countries that most Americans think of as paradigms of oppression.
Right. One thing that is probably, you know, worth mentioning is that our report, what we do is we combine the incarceration rates for prisons, state and federal, for jails, for juvenile detention facilities, for tribal jails, for civil commitment, for involuntary commitment. We put all these things together. So the rates that we have for U.S. states include types of incarceration that in many other countries that we consider to be our peers virtually don't exist. Juvenile detention, for instance. Tens of thousands of kids are behind bars on any given day in juvenile lockups, despite plenty of research showing that that's a very traumatic and counterproductive thing to do to young people. Other countries virtually never do that.
And another practice we have all over the place that very few other countries do is solitary, right?
That's right. Yeah. The same you can say of money bail, a system that we and the Philippines basically use exclusively. And that's a policy that has driven jail incarceration rates, so local jail rates, way higher in the last 20, 30 years. If you look at, you know, the reasons that jail populations have skyrocketed, it has a lot to do with pretrial incarceration and bail.
And incarceration rates have been drifting a little lower for a while, but what's happening now? They're going back up?
Yeah, I mean, during the pandemic, we saw the criminal legal system, just all the gears of the criminal legal system ground to a halt. Prosecutors were clearing fewer cases, police were arresting fewer people, and as a result of that, the incarcerated populations dropped somewhat significantly, and they've been kind of crawling back since then to where they used to be. The fact that prisons and jails are admitting fewer people, because that was the real driver of decarceration that year, and communities weren't seeing, you know, massive crime waves as a result of that, should we hoped that that would have a positive effect on criminal legal policy going forward, but it has not. So now we're seeing populations come back.
The states with the higher incarceration rates, they're just almost alone internationally, aren't they?
Yeah. I think it's 9 states that have higher incarceration rates than any country except for El Salvador, which is a country that's been run as a police state in recent years.
Speaking of the states, there does seem to be a creeping reaction among the various states, particularly the red states. Louisiana looks to be the avant-garde of that reaction. Over the last couple of months, they've been, increasing sentences, reversing some of the reforms, mild reforms, by the previous Democratic governor, John Bel Edwards. What's going on in Louisiana?
Yeah, so Louisiana has a new governor, Jeff Landry, well, new as of last year. And Landry has been putting in place some reforms that are truly horrible, right? The state is about to virtually eliminate discretionary parole, which, you know, is something that I should say a lot of other states have done, but typically when states do it, they will replace it with some other type of early release, like what we call determinate sentencing, which is a system, I think New York actually uses this for everyone sentenced today. The idea is that you are sentenced to a certain amount of time in prison and then a certain amount of time on mandatory supervision. And there isn't this element of a parole board that gets to decide if you go home even earlier than that or later than that or whatever. But most states that abolish parole do it that way. That's not how Louisiana is doing it. They're just going to be getting rid of it. And they're doing it in this way that really harkens back to the truth in sentencing movement of the 80s and the 90s, this idea that it's an insult to victims to allow people to earn early release, even if, you know, their behavior shows that they've totally changed who they are and they have a stable path to a better life after they get released. And it means that people who are sentenced before that law changes, before the abolition of parole, they qualify for some opportunities to go home early, and then people who happen to be sentenced after may serve 5, 10, 20 more years because they don't have that opportunity.
And we should say that Louisiana has the highest incarceration rate of any state in the country, right?
I should have led with that, yes. Louisiana even had the highest incarceration rate when John Bel Edwards was governor. But he, as you said, put in place these criminal justice reforms that were designed to cut incarceration. I believe that his administration reduced penalties for certain crimes. I think it tried to roll back the state's habitual offender law. These were all steps that were actually working, but it didn't get a chance to register in any of our biannual reports because now it's been rolled back.
And now Louisiana isn't alone. It's sounding in many states like the 90s all over again, though with far lower crime rates than 30 years ago. Now, there's an uptick in crime in the early pandemic days, but that's receded considerably, hasn't it?
We have the lowest crime rates in this country that we've seen in 60 years. That tends to get lost in conversations about incarceration. It's all sort of immaterial to, you know, the conversation we need to be having, which is about reducing harms in our communities stemming from things like drug addiction, homelessness, poverty. And those are, you know, those are choices that we can make as a society, or it's our choices that our lawmakers should be able to make by doing things like, you know, constructing affordable housing, investing in free public transit, making it possible for people to get healthcare for you know, particularly for mental health and drug issues in a safe way that respects their agency. Unfortunately, our society is not doing that.
In many cases, it's doing exactly the opposite, right? I mean,
yeah.
I was just looking at one of your reports, and a number of states are reviving the war on drugs. It's like it's you know, the Reagan days again.
That's unfortunately, you know, we have these extraordinarily high rates of incarceration, and many states are actively taking steps to go backwards on it. You know, like as you said, you know, I think in a lot of places it's a reaction from lawmakers who are trying to score cheap political points by saying, you know, I'm anti-woke, I'm not one of these people who are soft on criminals, et cetera, et cetera. In other places, and I think this is, you know, the Democratic Party must be held accountable for this at some point, even Democrats are jumping on the bandwagon and saying things like, we need to pass mandatory minimums for fentanyl possession, even though most people who possess fentanyl don't know that they are doing so. We're experiencing somewhat of a backward slide politically, and yeah, it doesn't look good.
There are a number of jurisdictions that are criminalizing homelessness now, too.
Right. Yeah. I mean, we're recording this, I think, right after the Supreme Court has made its final decision in the Oregon case. Oh, my gosh, the name is escaping me. The Supreme Court decided that it, you know, that states do not actually have an obligation to house everyone who is homeless in order to conduct sweeps on homeless camps. There's a new ruling out that's going to give cities and states much more latitude when it comes to clearing away homeless camps. And, you know, these are policies that do nothing to ameliorate the fact that people are being priced out of their own homes and that real estate prices in some places are simply unaffordable and that rents are way too high.
I'm speaking with Wanda Bertram of the Prison Policy Initiative. And then states are building prisons again, too.
Yeah, I mean, and yeah, states are building prisons. Counties are expanding their local jails. That's, if anything, an even starker trend. We have this phrase, if you build it, they will fill it. And because of that, our organization is working really hard to push back in counties that are considering jail expansion and states that are considering prison expansion, because usually what, you know, elected officials will say is we have to build these new facilities because we have overcrowded existing facilities. But of course, those decisions come without any consideration of pretrial reform, sentencing reforms, police reform that could reduce the number of people inside.
So why are the counties building more jails?
What they say on its face is true. Counties' jails are often overcrowded these days. They have more people than they're designed to hold.
Now, is that because they're arresting more people, or there are more people getting sentenced for, you know, short terms in jails, or what's going on there?
That's a good question. I know that there are an increasing number of people being arrested. There's also a trend where we're seeing the average length of stay in jails is going up, so people are spending longer in jails. I think both as a result of prosecutors, you know, the charges, the things people are charged with, are on the whole shifting in a more serious direction. And also courts are jammed up and public defense offices are underfunded, and all these different things have combined to increase the average length of stay. So that has driven overcrowding in some places. It doesn't change the fact that a lot of people who are in jail are there because, you know, for instance, they failed to appear at a court hearing. Even if that was not their fault, had nothing to do with a wish to abscond or evade justice. Police bring people in for failure to appear all the time. It is the single most common offense that I see as the reason why someone's in jail. And lots of people also brought in because they're in the middle of a mental health crisis, or because they're picked up for being on drugs, et cetera, or they were criminalized, you know, in the act of being homeless. There are a lot of ways that counties could reduce the number of people in jail, right? They could change the way that they respond to failure to appear in court. You know, they could change their bail practices, and some have, to great success. But, you know, instead, partly because of really, really entrenched private interests that benefit from new and bigger jails, they're not doing that.
I can just speak with the New York experience, but I just noticed there seem to be more people on the streets who are in just really severe distress. I think it's a combination of mental health issues, drugs, increased housing prices, increased social stresses post-COVID. I mean, it just seems like a whole array of things. But it does contribute to this sense of things being out of control, which seems to be what's fueling part of a crime panic. But I don't know. It doesn't seem like jailing those people is the way to solve the problem.
What strikes me personally is that, you know, these problems that I guess you'd call public disorder, that's something that, you know, absolutely is happening. But it's, you know, the way that we deal with it, it has so little to do with an interest in caring for these people. Pennsylvania, for instance, a court there just recently shot down an attempt to build a safe injection site. So Pennsylvania, you can't build a safe injection site in Pennsylvania for people who want to use drugs safely. I think that should kind of pretty well encapsulate the state of the country when it comes to investing in public health oriented solutions over you know, carceral ones. One bright spot I want to say is that, you know, the increased awareness that we need to be doing more to control rents and to build public housing. You know, the big push in states like California to increase the number of housing units and to make low income housing more accessible. You know, if there's one service that cities and states can be investing in to keep people from criminal justice involvement, it would be housing. And I think that a lot of people, if not a lot of lawmakers, do realize that.
The cops in jail lobby, they're really going heavily after reformist DAs, right?
A lot of reform DAs have been on the business end of the tough on crime reaction in the last few years. Chesa Bowden in San Francisco, a lot of people know that he lost his seat. Others have held their ground. Larry Krasner in Philadelphia, who was one of the initial vanguard progressive prosecutors, was challenged in the most recent elections for DA, and he beat his challenger in basically a landslide. And the votes that helped him win largely came from the parts of the city that have seen that are bearing the brunt of crime. So that should tell you something. People need to be brave and you know, continue running campaigns based on progressive values around you know, what we want to see from the criminal legal system.
Reformist DAs are often very popular locally. We just saw a victory of one in Albany, New York, who beat a guy who was once a reformist and then turned into a bad guy. Because of what looks like the popularity of some of these reformist DAs, states are limiting their capacity to act or even kicking them out of office.
Yeah. I mean, when what you said about the, you know, the police unions and CO unions, and even sometimes other prosecutors, retaliating against progressive prosecutors is absolutely true. You know, they face huge pushback from within their ranks, which I think should tell you that it's actually an effective reform strategy. Unfortunately, it's not enough to change how the criminal legal system works, you know, from the inside and what it's charging people with. You know, we really have to be disinvesting in in police forces and reinvesting in community services. And that's something that, quote unquote, progressive states are kind of the worst on this sometimes. States have been reinvesting in their police forces as opposed to defunding, which is, you know, what our organization still believes is necessary.
People on the right often try to explain the rise in crime that happened in 2020, 2021 as being a result of post-George Floyd defunding of the cops. But nobody actually defunded the cops anywhere, did they?
That's right. It's a complete fallacy. Most places didn't do anything about the funding that police departments received. And I think on the whole, the number of full-time police officers actually increased from 2020 to 2021. Any kind of crime wave has nothing to do with changes in police forces staffing.
And then the migrant panic is adding fuel to this fire.
Of course. Yeah.
Oh, I mean, you mentioned housing. Other than just keep trying to fight the good fight, is there any way out of this?
There are a number of ways, out of it. There are steps that cities and states would be wise to take, you know, in tandem. So if we just talk about housing, you know, for a very small sector of people, if we just talk about housing for people who have a mental illness or a substance use problem and are at risk of criminalization, cities would be very, very wise to make it really easy for these people to get housed. Unfortunately, they are often making it harder. And the way that they make it harder is by offering only short-term supportive housing, or if they even offer long-term supportive housing, conditioning it on people consenting to get treatment. That's not necessary. The research that exists on what are called housing first programs, which are permanent supportive housing programs that don't require people to get medical treatment for behavioral or drug disorders, but do make those programs available to people if they want them, have extremely high success rates. They keep tons of people stably housed over the long term. They are extremely effective at keeping people out of the criminal legal system. They haven't been as widely used as they should be, but there are places across all, you know, all parts of the country politically that are experimenting with this. Ohio, of all places, has one of the frontier programs in terms of the DOC partnering with a permanent supportive housing group. There's the FUSE program in New York. There are other programs all across the country that have experimented with this and seen great success. Salt Lake City had a permanent supportive housing program that has been much maligned by people who are distorting the facts, but was extremely successful while the city chose to invest in it. So there are certainly, I mean, there are ways out of the place that we're in right now with so few public services and such an emphasis on incarceration.
That was Wanda Bertram of the Prison Policy Initiative. You can find them on the web at prisonpolicy.org. That's it for me, Doug Henwood. Let's go with this, some of the liberation of the prisoners seen from Beethoven's Fidelio, performed by the Chicago Symphony Orchestra and chorus under Georg Scholte. Till next week, bye.